From KCRW, I'm Matt Holzman, filling in for Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
Maiden had been sort of put in a compartment of my life, although she continued with me through every other project. And then suddenly she burst back into my life as if to say, I think you've forgotten someone, and it's me.
A young sailor named Tracy Edwards made history when she skippered the first all-female crew in the Whitbread Round the World race. And she did it aboard a secondhand yacht named Maiden. 25 years later, Edwards learned Maiden had been abandoned, and at about the same time, someone wanted to make a film about her. Edwards set about saving Maiden the boat, while documentary director Alex Holmes began making Maiden the movie. Edwards and Holmes tell us about their parallel ventures and the globe-trotting quest to find the footage from Maiden's original voyage around the world. But first, it's the news banter. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW.
I'm Matt Bellany, filling in for the vacationing Kim Masters, and I'm joined this week by my partner in banter, Brooks Barnes of the New York Times. Hello, Brooks.
Hey there, how are you?
Doing well. So, Brooks, this week there was a little bit of a skirmish, shall we say, between the stars of a Netflix show called On My Block, which is heading into its third season, and the fight is over how much these stars are going to get paid. Typically in the television business, when you get to season two or three of a show that's deemed a hit, you then go back and renegotiate your salary. And these stars say they were making $20,000 an episode for the first season, and that's not very much, and they want more money, and they're using an interesting argument. They are claiming that because the head of Netflix programming, Cindy Holland, made a statement at a conference saying that On My Block is one of Netflix's most binged shows, that they should be paid in accordance with the stars of another show that Netflix is calling a hit, 13 Reasons Why. It's an interesting argument because it exposes this conundrum that Netflix has. They get a lot of value by not revealing how many people are watching because talent is largely kept in the dark. But then when they make these random boasts in public, talent is going to turn around and say, hey, wait a second, I want to get paid.
Yeah, it's what agents do. They use points of leverage for better pay. And Netflix is really sort of facing this, putting itself in a box by talking more and more about popularity. And the problem there is that you can't have it both ways. They want to be able to say, oh, this is a hit, and then no one else pays attention to what's not. But once you start talking about that, you know, you go for broke. A smart producer I know called the Sopranos effect, referring back to HBO in its early decades, didn't talk about ratings. It kept saying, oh, you know, we don't care about ratings. All we care about are subscriptions, and you're looking at our business wrong. And then suddenly The Sopranos was a big hit. They wanted to talk about it, and they had to basically live by ratings going forward.
Yeah, and it's not just Netflix that likes it. I mean, they are appealing to talent, ultimately. Netflix doesn't exist if talent won't work with them. And talent likes to know if they have produced a hit. In the history of Hollywood, there has always been independent verification of ratings or viewership. I mean, starting with box office all the way back in the teens and 20s, and moving on to the Nielsen ratings. And in music, you have the Billboard charts. And in streaming, there really isn't that thing. So Netflix has really taken advantage of that. And, you know, who knows how valuable these shows are to the network, and the talent sure doesn't know. And if I hear it all the time from agents, it's very, very frustrating for them to try to go in and get their clients paid what they deserve and what the market is demanding when they don't have a full picture of what's being consumed.
It's going to be interesting as some of these other services come online, especially because Comcast, for example, is going to take ads. And so when you're selling ads, you've got to tell those advertisers how many viewers you're delivering to them. That will help talent know what their show is worth. And Netflix may find itself having to show more leg, as I sometimes say, on those data points.
Yeah, and there's a lot of these new streamers coming on board, Apple, Warner Media, you said Comcast and Disney Plus, and they haven't said what kind of transparency they're going to offer with respect to viewership. And it would seem that there's a place in the market to appeal to talent by saying, listen, we'll give you a full accounting of who's watching this, and maybe that's a competitive advantage against Netflix. And all of this goes back to the challenge of valuing content in the streaming age. And we saw a huge deal this past week where NBC Universal, which owns The Office, they made a decision to take The Office away from Netflix and move it over to this new Comcast-developed streaming service at the end of 2020. And Comcast is paying about $500 million for 5 years of The Office. And that's a huge amount of money, but is that the right amount of money? Is that too much? Is it not enough? I mean, we've seen in some of these surveys that The Office is one of the most popular binge shows on Netflix. And does that translate to a new Comcast streaming service? Well, presumably there will be an ad-supported element as well as subscription. Or was that number because The Office was on Netflix and, you know, they're overpaying for this? I don't know the answer.
No one really does. And we'll find out, I guess, when it comes onto that streaming service. I think in 2021 is when it officially moves there, those reruns. I mean, it's been such a big hit because younger viewers, Netflix has a lot of those, discovered it. You know, for them, it was a first run show, not reruns. Whether that phenomenon continues over at Comcast is unclear.
Yeah, and the joke of this all is that when The Office was on NBC in the, you know, mid-aughts, it was always considered a bubble show. It was never considered one of the, you know, levers of NBC and the hits that were driving the network. And now in this streaming age, the way people are consuming content, it's sort of like comfort food. People turn it on and there's a ton of episodes, unlike most Netflix shows that, you know, don't have a ton of episodes, and you could just watch and watch and watch. And that's the essence of these streaming hits in many ways. Friends is the same way, and it's one of the most popular shows on Netflix, but maybe Warner Media will take that back. I want to pivot to one other topic here that we discussed a few weeks ago on The Business, but has become a hotter topic now, and that's the fight between the agents and the writers over packaging fees and television and this practice of agencies producing shows and thus becoming the employer of their clients. And the writers are suing the agencies, claiming that the agencies have enacted this kind of mafia mentality and are taking profits from shows in a way that sometimes give them more money from shows than their clients make. And the agencies fired back this past week, alleging antitrust arguments against the Writers Guild, essentially arguing that the Writers Guild has overstepped its bounds as a union representing writers and are essentially demanding that writers not work with particular agencies in violation of anti-competitive laws.
So this is the first time that the big agencies have gone to court in their battle. William Morris Endeavor was the first one here, and then UTA followed. CAA and ICM are likely to file their own lawsuits. In the WME lawsuit, they said it was, quote, an unlawful boycott and, you know, railed against the writers for an unprecedented abuse of union authority. I mean, one thing that interests me is just that this is sort of getting embarrassing for the agencies. Agents close deals for a living. You know, what's happening, folks?
It is embarrassing, but what you have here is another embarrassing thing in that the Writers Guild has gone to the SEC in Washington and written a letter claiming that Endeavor, which owns WME, is essentially lying to the SEC by overstating the number of clients it has in its effort to go public, which Endeavor has stated it's trying to do. And that's a pretty big claim in front of the SEC. If you lie on your filing documents, you know, the entire IPO could be called off. So this has gotten especially nasty on both sides, but this ultimately does come back to, like, guys, can't you make a deal here? You know, cut the writers in on something, you know, make a concession that's going to be meaningful to them and get a deal done. I mean, that doesn't seem like it's going to be the end of the world until when you talk to some agents, when they say, why should we? We provide value here. We are doing a service for these writers. If they don't want our services, then that's fine. They don't have to take our services.
The hard line is one that both sides have adopted. I mean, the agencies did come back last week or the week before saying, here's an improved deal. And whether or not that was, the writers rejected it, how improved it was versus whether it was just a, you know, precursor to these lawsuits. Depends on your point of view, but absolutely it'll be fighting its way through the courts now.
And one interesting thing is that many writers have said that life has gone on and that they've been able to find work without the benefit of having an agency working for them. I don't know how long that will last, however. Thank you, Brooks.
Let's do this all the time.
That's Brooks Barnes. He covers Hollywood for the New York Times.
You don't own me. I'm not just one of your.
The new documentary, Maiden, tells the amazing story of the first all-female crew to compete in the grueling Whitbread Round the World sailing race. At the helm of one of the boats in 1989 was 26-year-old Tracy Edwards, an ambitious but totally untested skipper who had a difficult adolescence in Wales, then escaped to Europe and got her start sailing as a kind of nautical vagabond working on charter yachts. Tracy had bigger boating aspirations, but as she remembers in the documentary, racing crews were not exactly eager to hire her.
Sailing at that time was very male-dominated. There were just no women anywhere in it.
The Whitbread Round the World race at 33,000 miles is the longest and most challenging on Earth.
I wanted to get past this. I remember going to the skipper and he went, "We're not going to be the only racing team in the world, but a girl." And that's when I made the decision to put an all-female crew into the race.
Before the race even began, there was a long struggle to find a sponsor for her boat and the 12 women who would sail her. Once they finally did set off, Maiden and her crew faced brutal conditions, especially in the Southern Ocean, where freezing weather and towering waves made it a challenge to just stay on deck.
It's like hitting a brick wall in a car without your seatbelt on every 10 seconds. It's just relentless.
There's a lot of slamming. Boom, bang, boom, bang. Takes a lot out of the boat.
Maiden and her crew made it through, but they didn't just finish. They actually won a couple of the legs of the race, and after it was all over, Tracy Edwards became the first woman to win the prestigious Yachtsman of the Year award. Edwards' story with Maiden seems like such a naturally cinematic one. When I sat down with the sailing pioneer and documentary director Alex Holmes, I had to ask, so Tracy and Alex, why haven't we seen this film until right now?
Well, that's a great question. And actually, it was a question I asked myself the first time I heard Tracy tell this story. In fact, it was a story she told at my daughter's elementary school. And as she described it, I could see a film unfolding in my imagination. But it was such a good story that by the end of her talk, I thought, this must have been done already. I've just missed it somehow along the way. You know, this is such a good story. Someone was banned to have done this. So my first question to Tracy that evening when I went up to her was, has this ever been done? And I was really surprised and, I'll admit it, pleased when she said no. It hadn't been turned into a film. Of course, at that stage, I was imagining it as a dramatic film, a narrative film, because I had no idea that they would have had cameras or that even that it might have been possible to have cameras on board back in 1989 because they spent a long time away from land in damp conditions, salt water, all the things that are anathema to video cameras. So I thought the chances were negligible. But Tracy corrected me and told me that they had cameras on board the whole way around, and that presented a golden opportunity to make this into a documentary.
So Tracy, he walks up to you and suggests that he make a film about your experience. What was your first reaction?
I wasn't as enthusiastic as possibly I might have been immediately. really just because the few years before that, I'd been on quite a roller coaster ride in my life and had a few ups and downs and felt a bit battered and bruised. And my level of trust in my fellow man at that point was at an all-time low. But I listened and we met up and he told me, you know, that 25 years after something is a really great time to make a film because you tend to be a lot more honest than you would have been at the time and, you know, the passage of time and life and everything else. So I did at that point become very interested, but I did say I would have to check with the girls because it would have to be a team effort. It's not just about me. And also, I think that we all felt very strongly over the years that we needed to protect Maiden's legacy. And I think we all saw this as an opportunity for Maiden to have a legacy that wasn't necessarily word of mouth or the book or whatever. So we all got to the point where we agreed. And then the next question all the girls asked me was, how honest are we going to be about this? So I knew what they meant. And I said, well, let's do it warts and all. You know, let's really show people how hard it was. And also because I do a lot of talks at girls' schools where I think sometimes girls aren't just expected to be, you know, successful. They need to be perfect while they're successful. And we know that that's just not the case. And so I wanted the story to be as raw and as truthful and as, you know, sort of soul searching as possible.
So this footage that was taken of the race around the world on Maiden, I assume was probably all in one place, indexed perfectly in a climate controlled, right?
That's what I dreamt. I used to dream that at night, that there would be some box somewhere and it would you'd open up the lid and in it would be all of the original tapes in pristine condition, all carefully labeled. But that was not to be, no.
So where was the footage?
It was literally scattered to the four corners of the earth. I mean, what had happened on this race was that they had filmed that they'd gone around as they got to port at the end of each leg. The tapes had been offloaded, or, you know, instantly. One of the first things passed across was the tapes. All the news crews hungry for the footage. They had then taken those, copied them, cut them up, put them into news packages. And then who knows what happened to the original rushes, but they certainly weren't protected or corralled. And it was a detective job going around to all the libraries, trying to piece everything together. You'd sometimes find half a piece of footage in one library and half a piece of footage in another library, and you'd have to stitch them together to make a sequence because everybody was cutting different stories from the same rushes that were being produced by Maiden and a couple of the other boats. So it really was a detective job. But you know, we were encouraged. The more we found, the more encouraged we were, because the quality of the footage that came from Maiden was extraordinary. And a lot of that is down to the incredible camera work of Joe Gooding, who was the cook on board, Tracy's childhood friend, who was the first person she recruited onto the boat. You know, she very quickly understood the nature of verite cinematography, just allowing the camera to linger on people, to really get under their skin, to paint these portraits of the characters on the boat and the mood on the boat. And it was in great contrast to some of the material that you got off the couple of other boats that had cameras on board. On the guys' boats, they would do much more formal setups, you know, interviews to camera, reporting their position and the position of the stars and the sun and all that kind of stuff. But none of that emotional content that Joe just harvested along the way. And for a filmmaker, that's gold dust.
Had she ever worked with a camera before this?
No. No, she, well, we all looked around at each other after I'd volunteered our services to be one of the few boats that had cameras on board. And we all looked at Joe, really, and we said, well, you know, you're not doing a watch. And she said, oh, no, I would absolutely love to do the camera work. And so we packed her off to the BBC, who very kindly spent 4 days teaching her how to use a camera.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, a whole 4 days. And so she came back with this camera, which, you know, Joe's not the tallest person in the world, so it was quite funny looking at her with this sort of quite large camera. But I think what was really good about what we did was we practiced. So a lot of the guys, I think, just put the camera to one side and said, yeah, we'll get onto that once we go sailing. But we went out sailing with the camera and we worked out how to use it, and Joe practiced on us. And then what we did realise, and this is what set us apart from the other boats, is we realised that there are times when you do need all 12 members up on deck, you know, and it's all hands on deck. You drop whatever you're doing and you go up and you help because something catastrophic may be happening. And so once this had happened a couple of times, the first time she came up with the camera and I just looked at her and went, you can put that down for a start. So we thought, what do we do about this? And in the end, we got hold of another camera and we fixed it to the radar mast pointing forwards over the boat. So every time we had an emergency, the last person out, their job was to hit the panic button and that would start filming. So we ended up with this extraordinary footage that no other boats had because they wouldn't film when it was rough.
Were you ever concerned? I know there's even a scene in the documentary where you were admonishing everyone on the crew to not have more than one bag because weight is key. And now you have these heavy cameras and heavy cans of film. Were you thinking, we have to dump that?
No, we felt instinctively that it was really important for us to film what we were doing. No matter what happened, whether we won, lost or didn't make it, we felt there had to be a record of the first women to sail around the world. And I'm really glad that we made that call. But I have to say, so many other things were smuggled onto the boat that I didn't know anything about. So, and only found out about 30 years later.
I'll ask you about that later.
Yeah, I'm glad we did it.
Coming up after a short break, Tracy Edwards and Alex Holmes hint that there may be yet another movie version of Maiden in the works. You're listening to The Business from KCRW. This is The Business, and I'm Matt Holzman, filling in for Kim Masters. We're talking to Alex Holmes, director of the new documentary Maiden, and Tracy Edwards, who skippered the boat of the same name 30 years ago, leading an all-women crew around the world in one of the most punishing races on Earth. Few people in the mostly male yachting world thought Edwards would ever make her dream a reality. And then after she managed to put her crew together and restore an old sailing yacht, they doubted Maiden would finish the race, much less win a couple of legs. Early on, the media wouldn't even ask Tracy and the crew questions about sailing. But as the weeks ticked by and Maiden performed well, reporters finally started to take notice, though their questions were still sexist.
And a few people were giving you a sort of hard time in the media in the week or so leading up to the start. I mean, are you just happy to keep sailing at the moment?
If I listened to what everyone said about me, I wouldn't be here now. So the people that count think this is a good thing. I think it's a good thing. And I'm just really pleased that we've been allowed to do it.
A few years ago, when director Alex Holmes set out to make a documentary about Maiden, he ran into problems of his own.
You know, initially, for me, this story was a no-brainer. This was going to be a great film. I could see it from the outset. I had total confidence in it. That didn't seem to be an opinion that was shared by everybody. People were always interested and wanted to hear about it. But when it came to actually putting their hands in their pockets and financing the movie, shall we say there was a slow start. And, you know, we funded it ourselves as a company. I have a company with two, really, it's kind of a collective between three of us. We're all passionate documentary makers, and we know that it is a passion rather than a profession. Mm-hmm. So we kept it going and used whatever resources we had to keep the search going for the footage, hoping that one day funds would come through. And thankfully they did. But, you know, ultimately you have to make a film like this on a smaller budget as you can. And we were fortunate in that the right creative choice seemed to be to make it just with interviews and with the footage and let those two elements speak for themselves rather than do anything more elaborate, which helped keep the cost down. But, you know, eventually we did get some private finance and that was great. And it was always touch and go and we were still struggling for money at the end to finish the film. But by that time we had confidence in the material and we knew we had a success in our hands. So it was a little easier to bet on ourselves at that stage. Right. And thankfully, when it showed at Toronto, you know, it got a great reception and the deficit started to right itself. We're just about on an even keel, I'd say, right now. But, you know.
So I'm wondering if there was any pushback on you, Alex, that a man was going to direct a film about this amazing female accomplishment.
I think there were a few raised eyebrows. Ironically, perhaps less so at the beginning, because, of course, you know, we started this process of deciding to tell this story 5 years ago. And that was a little time before the Me Too movement had really kind of got into gear. And I'm all for encouraging women directors, you know, as much as possible. But we are a small company. We had decided to make this film. And the one thing I do know, in especially in documentary filmmaking, is the only reason a film ever gets made is the passion of an individual to make it. And I felt I had that passion. And also, I was encouraged by my relationship with Tracy, who I think, you know, I listened to what she had to say. And I felt it was my job to really put her story, you know, on the screen. That was my role. I was there as an interpreter of her story rather than someone who was telling their own story.
Yeah, I think I felt that he had a real feel for the story and there was a trust that we built up with each other. And it's interesting, actually, I don't mean this rudely to Alex or anything, but I never thought of Alex as a man. And as I say, I don't mean this rudely. Alex has many feminine qualities, but I saw him as a person, and a human being who was interested in our story. And no one else had come to me and said, you know, I'd like to make your story. So we went with the person who we felt had a passion and a deep instinctive understanding of our story. And we were not disappointed, because when we watched the documentary all together for the first time, Alex was actually the most nervous person in the room, but we were also slightly, didn't know what to expect. And as we watched it, we knew we'd chosen the right person.
Mm-hmm. So, Alex, while you were raising money for the film, I understand that Tracy was raising money to resurrect Maiden, which was off somewhere in the world and was decaying rapidly.
It's so synchronistic that everything that's happened with the documentary and with Maiden's third life has just sort of come together. And really, I had found out about Maiden being abandoned in the Seychelles and the fact that they were going to take her out and sink her if someone didn't come and, you know, sort of get her. And then 2 weeks later, I meet Alex and it's like Maiden had been sort of put in a compartment of my life, although she continued with me, as I say, through every other project. And then suddenly she burst back into my life as if to say, I think you've forgotten someone, and it's me. And it was just at a point in my life, this is no word of a lie, I'd just finished one job and I was literally thinking, I need a project. I don't want a 9-to-5 job again. I really can't do that. I want a project, something I get my teeth into. And then both of these things happened at the same time. So we did these two projects, the documentary and Rescuing Maiden, did run parallel in extraordinary ways, I have to say. So yes, we were looking for the money at the same time. We then bought Maiden in October 2016. And so we brought her back to the UK. We completely restored her, very long, intense and in-depth restoration. And she then started her 2.5-year world tour raising funds and awareness for girls' education in November, which is when the Maiden documentary went to Toronto and was bought by Sony Pictures Classics. So the whole thing has been quite surreal.
Well, I'm curious to know, though, if both the Maiden Factor, the foundation that has resurrected Maiden and is taking her around the world, and the fundraising for the film, did you ever approach some of the standard kind of funders in the world of yacht racing? And, you know, this many years later, how are they seeing Maiden? Were they encouraged at the idea of telling the story, or were they a little embarrassed by it?
From a film finance point of view, I think that, you know, the yachting community was more interested in investing in boats than in films. So it wasn't something that had a great deal of favor. And I think from a lot of people's perspective, you know, there are a wealth of stories in the world of sailing, I'm sure, that could be made into a film. You know, for me, Maiden was a very special story because it was about more than sailing, so much more than sailing. We obviously went and asked, but we didn't have great high hopes of the sailing community thinking this was the sailing story that had to be told for all time.
And I think from my point of view, the guys that fund sailing fund men's sailing. Very few people fund female sailing. And it's still, I would say, well, the difference between 30 years ago and now is 30 years ago, we had a very quick, instantaneous, no, we're not going to sponsor you. Whereas 30 years later, we have to go through this quite torturous few months where we speak to companies and they don't want to say no immediately because we're a bunch of women. And so we go through this process of, oh, well, this company is committed and dedicated to diversity at the top of our company. And we're desperately trying to get women to break the glass ceiling, get into the boardroom. And, you know, we love your project. We love Maiden. We love female empowerment and girls' education. So we have this for a few months while they tick a few boxes. And we get to the end and they say, yeah, no, we've decided to sponsor men's football. And you just go, how do you even compare those two things? So there's a tick box exercise going on at the moment, which I'm finding quite frustrating, if I'm honest. You know, we still need to find a sponsor to get Maiden around the rest of the world. Otherwise, she's going to be spending quite a long time in San Francisco.
I don't know. It seems like an incredible way to sell Rolexes to women, but that's just me.
I had exactly the same thought.
Yeah. So, as Tracy said, the film found a distributor at Toronto and Sony Pictures Classics. I'm wondering, has there been talk of a narrative version?
I don't think I can say too much about the subject.
I think you just did. I think you. So, who would you, in an ideal world, who would you like to play you?
Oh, God, that's so hard. Well, the thing is, she has to be so young because, you know, I was, what was I, 23 when I started Maiden. I'm sure there's someone as nutty as I am out there somewhere.
Alex Holmes is the director of the documentary Maiden, and Tracy Edwards is the subject. She was the captain of Maiden, which sailed in the Whitbread Around the World race. Thank you, both of you, for talking to us on The Business.
Thank you so much.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Paul Smith. You can subscribe to The Business as well as other great KCRW shows at kcrw.com/podcasts. I'm Matt Holzman. Kim Masters will be back next week on The Business.